Today's Taisho is on case 35 in the Mumonkan. Case 35 is Seijo's soul separated. Goso said to his monks, Seijo's soul separated from her being, which was the real Seijo. Mumon's comment, when you realize what the real is, you will see that we pass from one husk to another like travelers stopping for a night's lodging. But if you do not realize it yet, I earnestly advise you not to rush about wildly. When earth, water, fire, and air suddenly separate, you will be like a crab struggling in boiled water with its 7 or 8 arms and legs. When that happens, don't say, I didn't warn you. Mumon's verse, the moon above the clouds is ever the same. Valleys and mountains are separate from each other. All are blessed, all are blessed. Are they one or are they two? So this is day two of our August session, and an incredible turnaround in the weather. If we had asked for the perfect weather, we couldn't do better than this. It's been cool and beautiful. It's just wonderful to sit in this weather. So I want to thank everybody for doing such a good job in the Zendo this morning. People sat really still and deeply. Thank you so much for that. And thank you for coming to Sesshin. You know, this is a story about a person who doesn't do what her true nature tells her to do, basically. This is a story about a woman named Seijo, S-E-I-J-O. And it's based upon an old Chinese sort of folk tale. But in the folk tale, there was a town in China, and there was a little girl and a little boy who used to play together all the time, and they really enjoyed each other's company. And people would see the little boy and the little girl walking through town. And they would sometimes, you know, this is like little kids, you know, like 5 years old, they'd be holding hands, right? And people would see these two little kids walking down the street, this boy and this girl, and they'd say, here comes the old couple. Right? And they'd laugh. Here comes the old couple. So anyway, you know, as they were growing up, they began to be ensnared, you could say, in the society in which they lived. So, you know, basically, that kind of friendship that they had early on wasn't really sustainable after a certain point. They became teenagers and they still liked to see each other, but as they approached adulthood, society had other plans for them. So in the case of Seijo, her parents had decided to marry her off to someone else, not to her old friend. And this is a pre-modern world. This happened everywhere, Europe, Asia, Latin America. You know, basically, you married the person you were, who was chosen for you by your parents. This still happens in parts of the world, like there are still places in India where this goes on. But it was a universal until about 100 years ago. So, you know, her family made a decision that Seijo should marry a certain person from a good family, and And she didn't want to marry this other person. She wanted to marry her old boyfriend. And her parents said, you know, you can't do that. You know, you're part of our family. You have responsibilities, and you have to discharge your responsibilities. You have to do what we want you to do. So anyway, according to the ghost story, or the folk story, I should say, you know, Seijo and her boyfriend got together, and she was sobbing, and she said, I don't want to marry that man. I want to marry you. And her boyfriend said, well, I guess the only thing we can do is to elope. We're going to have to go get married, and then, of course, we'll have to leave this village and never come back. And it broke Seijo's heart to leave her parents behind, but she did just that. You know, she left her parents, and she went off with her boyfriend, and they sailed across some water and settled on an island. Maybe it was Hainan Island or something like that. And there they made a life of themselves. And they got married, and they had several children. And they were very happy, but one day the husband came home, and Seijo was crying. And he said, why are you crying? And she said, I'm crying because I miss my family so much, my heart. I have so much happiness here. But, you know, I miss my mother, I miss my father, I miss my brothers and sisters. I wish I could go back. So her husband says, well, why don't we give it a try? Why don't we sail back and go see them and show them that we've made a good life, we've lived a good life, we love each other, our relationship has been wonderful. So, you know, they sail back across the water, and they're in their boat in the moorings, and Seijo says, you know, I'm really getting cold feet. I don't know that I can confront them right now. So her husband says, okay, I'll take care of it. I'll go first, and I'll present myself to them. And so the husband goes back to the village. And he finds the home, the villa of Seijo's family. And he knocks on the door. And Seijo's mother comes to the door. And he says, do you remember me? I used to live in this village. I was the boy who ran away with Seijo. And we've been living on an island. And we have been married, and we have a wonderful life. And the mother's looking at him incredulous, like he's a madman. And she says, what are you talking about? You know, my daughter Seijo had been in her bed upstairs for the last 10 years. You know, we tried to force her to marry somebody she didn't love. And she took to her bed, and she's been in a kind of catatonic state. And the boyfriend, now the husband, says, that can't be possible. You know, I've been living with Seijo all these years, for the last 10 years. We have a family. We have a house. So he goes back to the boat, and he gets Seijo, and he brings her up to her old village, and brings her to her old home. And when the mother sees Seijo with the husband, she doesn't know what to do. It doesn't make any sense. And so they all go upstairs to Seijo's bedroom, and when they open the door, Seijo's sitting in a catatonic state on the bed. And so this is according to the folktale, you know, when the Seijo, who ran away, sees the Seijo on the bed. She approaches the sick Seijo on the bed, and the two suddenly magically become one. So, you know, this is a Chinese folktale that expresses a lot about Chinese society, right? you know, the expectations that Chinese society exerts on people and how it makes them prisoners, right? I mean, this folktale is about people who love each other who can't fulfill their love because society has other plans. And it's about people who rebel against the society but then pay a certain cost. You know, so this makes sense in our culture too. We don't have forced marriages, but we definitely have expectations that we have to live up to. And those expectations follow us all through our lives. And in our culture, they're not the same as in Seijo's culture. But we definitely have them, you know. We all grow up getting messages from our society and from our parents, from our teachers, about who we are and what we should be. And these messages are very powerful because they're tied in with our desire for self-respect and love. So, you know, we want to please our parents, we want to please our teachers, we want to please people we admire. And so we become what they want us to become to some degree. And this can have take many different forms, but you know, we can live our whole life trying to fulfill the roles that people have asked us to play. And it's very difficult to be genuine if you're living that way, and yet most people live that way. So you know, one of the problems for people is how to be free, how to be spontaneous, how to be truly alive. And it's not easy because we've gone through so many years of trying to please others and trying to be what society expects us to be. And so I often think that Zen, one way to think about Zen practice is that it's an invitation to discover the person you weren't able to be, you know, because of social expectations. And to some degree, we're all a little bit like Seijo. You know, we're all a little bit on the bed, lifeless sometimes, because of social expectations. And sometimes we've forgotten all about the other Seijo, that other person. Or it's only like a dim memory that presents itself from time to time. You know, so I think most people grow up distrusting themselves. And that's because, you know, early on we had to do things that society wanted us to do that we didn't necessarily feel a natural connection to doing. Now, you know, in a lot of ways we benefit from this. You know, I definitely had to do things that I didn't want to do as a kid. And now, basically I'm so happy I could do that. You know, my niece used to have to play the piano. And she would cry and she would fight, and my mother would have to make her go do her piano lessons, you know. I think my niece hated the piano for many years, you know. And it was the way it was taught to her, you know. It was an expectation. And I was reading, I don't know if you saw this article, about a year ago there was an article about a very famous, very promising musician, pianist, In New York, he had been groomed for greatness. You know, he studied with all the great piano teachers in the New York area, and he was all set to become this major star. And he walked away from it all. The article was about how he was living. I think he was living on Long Island, and he had become a boat builder. You know. You could see the reporter didn't quite know what to make of this. You know, I think that this is a good example, but there are many examples. How do we really live authentically? And we develop these habits, right, of self-judgment. You know, it's like we become our own keepers, in a way. You know, we become our own. Our parents are long gone, and yet we're still maintaining those lessons ourselves. We become our own keepers. So, you know, spontaneity is very difficult, and I think in our society, in a contemporary society, it takes a different form. So, you know, I am a teacher, and when on the first day of class, when I come into class, all my students are on their cell phones. And you know, the thing that I notice about all these students being on their cell phones is that they don't look particularly happy, right? You know, it would be interesting if I came in and I looked and all my students were on their cell phones, and I looked at their faces, and their faces were glowing with joy, you know. But generally, that's not the case. You know, generally, they're scrolling through something or poring over something, and they actually look tense and unhappy. And I think cell phones, in some ways, are if you're caught in your cell phone habits. You know, they're very regimenting. They're as regimenting as any society could ever imagine. You know, it's the people have done studies, and they find that many younger people are on their cell phones like 4 hours a day, seriously. And there's actually cases, many cases now in high school and junior high school, of people having sort of like psychological disorders, because you know you've got to text your friends, and then you know if you say something your friends don't like, they can gang up on you, you know, seriously. So you're constantly maintaining your social relations with all your friends by texting or other kinds of electronic communication, and sometimes it goes sour and people gang up on you or throw you out. And then the kids get really depressed. You know, they actually, you know, there have been suicides. You know, I think this is a modern version of the Seijo story, you know. The people who invented cell phones and so on don't care about your well-being. They just want you to use their apps or use their devices, and you know the people on the internet just want you to hit their site so that they can have so many visits or so many views. They don't really care about you, but what they do care is monopolizing your attention. Now I don't know if you ever saw the. It's not a, a very. I can't even remember the. It's a terrible movie. Let me put it that way. It's called Scrooged, with Bill Murray. If you haven't seen it, please don't. But it's about a guy who's a television producer, and he's putting on a Christmas Carol, a version of the Christmas Carol. And he's putting it on, and he meets with all his researchers, and they're trying to find a version of the Christmas Carol that will reach the maximum demographic. So they're rewriting the script to get everything in there, and at one point he says, you know, our studies show that cats are now watching TV. And he says, so we're going to put some mice into the script, even though there's not mice in Charles Dickens' story. We'll put some mice in for cat interest. So anyway, this guy's a totally cynical and unhappy person. And he's visited by the ghosts of Christmas in the Charles Dickens story. And he's visited by the ghost of Christmas past. And the ghost of Christmas past asks him about his childhood. And he says, oh, well, one time we did this. And the ghost of Christmas past says, no, you didn't do that. That was a TV show. That was Leave It to Beaver. Right? And he said, well, we did this. And he said, no, that was... And he just, every time the guy has a memory, it turns out to be a memory of a TV show. Right? So he actually didn't have any life. His life was watching other people live on TV. Well, I think the electronic media are very much like that. It's very spellbinding. That whole system is very spellbinding. And, one day, all these people who have been spending 4 hours a day on their phone, as the end of their lives approach, that's going to really add up. It's like, well, what did you do with your life? Well, I spent a lot of time on the phone. Right. Why do people do that? There's a lot of evidence that that makes people unhappy psychologically. There's a lot of evidence that people who say spend a lot of time on Facebook have higher rates of depression than people who don't. There's a lot of evidence that actually sort of obsessively texting makes people unhappy. Why do they do it? Well, it's because it's approved of, right? I mean, everybody's supposed to get, when Apple puts out a new phone, they always have stories in magazines about how people are lined, that people camp out on the street to get the new iPhone, right? From somebody in my generation, that's pretty amazing, that anybody would sleep on the street to get a new phone, right? You used to call the Bell telephone and they'd deliver it and you could have a choice. It was black or black when I was a kid, right? And then they had color phones. Suddenly you could have red ones, Nobody would have stayed up late for a phone, right? This is all a spellbinding social pressure designed to make you obsessively concerned, right, about your electronic communication. And the people who did it didn't have your best interests in mind. Now, your parents probably had your best interests in mind, but, your parents also had agendas for you that basically come out of their own sense of inadequacy or their own sense of unfulfilled wishes. And I loved my parents, and I know they wanted what was best for me, but, they're gone and I'm here. I have to live my life, right? So Zen is about... to come to Sesshin is itself like an act of, is an interesting act, an interesting action. Because, nothing in our society approves of people doing this. You won't be able to put this on your CV, for example. And there's probably, I hope there's no way to monetize this, right? But there are many things you could have done with your time instead of coming here. But you came here, and I think that's something inside you asked you to come here. And I would say what asked you to come here is the person, is the seijo who is living on the island happily with her husband. See? And I think we all have a kind of like divided consciousness. Somewhere inside of us there is this memory of, like you could say, spontaneity, being alive. Sometimes something will just make you alive, right? I can remember, when I was in graduate school at the University of Washington, there was so much pressure. And there was psychological pressure, there were deadlines, so I would go to my graduate class and I would try to contribute to the class, and maybe the professor didn't like what I was saying and say, no, it's not like that. So I'd leave the class and think, okay, well, fine. Then I'd go to teach my own class and my student would be upset about his grade, so I'd argue with, And other things would happen in my life, and I felt a lot of the time like I was just striking out at every pitch. And I put a lot of pressure on myself too. So what if my professor doesn't agree? So what if he doesn't agree with me? So what? But at the time, that meant a lot for me to disagree with him. Was difficult for me. And I wanted all my students to love me, and this student clearly didn't love me because I didn't give him an A. And I remember coming out of the building, the English department building, and walking towards my house and turning around and seeing Mount Rainier up in the sky. And it was just the most amazing moment, because I felt totally liberated. It was like all of this stuff is unimportant. And there's something much bigger here. Just being alive is so much bigger than these concerns. Being alive is so much bigger than all of this stuff. And we, as we grow up, we lose touch with that energy sometimes. So a lot of the time, people can feel very stressed out, very anxious, and very drained. Like drained. No energy. And so a lot of us are sort of like sajos. We're sajos. We're going through the motions, but every once in a while, we get in touch with that energy. And it happens sometimes spontaneously. But, Zen is about sort of like undoing the barriers that keep that energy away. It's like unconditioning the mind. The Buddhist view is that natural human state is energy, is alive, is actually happy. The natural human state, according to Buddhism, is energized and happy. And that's so far from the reality for most people. And you can say, well, how come we're not energized and happy? And it's because we've picked up a lot of behaviors, including deeply rooted psychological behaviors that make us unhappy and energyless. Right? One of them is obsessive texting and worrying about what other people are going to say about us if we're not monitoring our communications minute by minute. And that is truly hell, right?
I have this job at Rutgers, which was, not the job I wanted. I got this job at Rutgers by accident. The job I wanted was at a place called Pomona College in California. And when I read the job description, it was exactly like it had been written for me. It was all the things I did on my dissertation. Everything I was doing was in that job description. And I thought, I am going to get this job at Pomona College. I am the person this job was written for. And so I went to the interview, and I didn't get the job. A very famous person got the job. In fact, they probably wrote it for that person. They didn't write it for me. But the interesting thing was, I also went for a job interview at Rutgers to run a writing program, which is something I had done a little bit of work in graduate school. And when I took this job at Rutgers, you know, it was definitely not what I wanted. But, you know, the strangest thing was that, consciously, I really didn't want to do this. You know, it was like, this is, one of my dissertation directors said, you're making a big mistake taking this job. He says, this is the end of your career in Renaissance if you take this job. You're giving that up. So, you know, I didn't really have another job option, so I decided to take this job at Rutgers. I didn't even think they were serious about me, but you know, in fact, they wanted me to send something I had written, and I didn't send it. And I got a call from the chair and said, where is it? And I said, you're serious? And he said, well, of course we're serious, damn it, you know. So I sent it to him, and I got the job. And when I came out to Rutgers, you know, I really discovered that I loved this job. How do I know I love it? Because I actually would get up in the morning excited about it, and I would feel alive when I did it. And if you had asked me 3 years earlier, you know, basically, would you like this kind of job? I would have said, absolutely not. What a disaster. But it was that sense of energy. Now, you know, I get that sense of energy on the cushion. If you said to somebody, would you like to sit in a painful posture for 8 hours a day and not get enough sleep, you know, you would probably say, no, that sounds like a terrible idea. But strangely, around day three, there's a kind of energy and spontaneity, freedom, that's unlike anything I've ever experienced in anything else. I do a lot of things I like, you know, I love my job, you know, I like to hike, but, you know, around day three of Sesshin, I feel, you know, this, I am encountering my true Seijo. You know, and it takes a lot of work. You know, trying to be spontaneous is very difficult. Because, you know, we don't allow ourselves to be spontaneous. And even when we try to be spontaneous, there's still all those layers of conditioning that get in the way. It takes a lot of effort to decondition ourselves. And so people are rather naive about what will set them free, right? So, you know, actually, when Apple comes out with a new phone, people are going to rush for that phone. And they're going to feel so free the day they buy that phone that the Apple company knows how to sell these phones. It's going to make people feel like they're the coolest people in the world. You know, they've got the coolest cutting-edge phone. Look at what it can do. You're so great. You're so freedom. And then people are going to be nervously texting all day long with anxious faces for 5 hours a day instead of four because of the new apps. See? So there's a lot of deceptive liberation out there. You know, that's really just actually playing on your conditioning and promising, I would say, a freedom that it can't deliver. There's something about this process, you know, it is peeling back the layers of your conditioning. And it's like you're following the breath out and your mind becomes blank, it's like, you're going back to literally to square one. And you can, little by little, all of these koans are about deconditioning yourself and rebuilding yourself in a new way with the free, happy Seijo at the center. And if you're a certain kind of Seijo, you don't dare be that other person. You don't trust your desire to be that other person. And maybe people have even told you, don't be that kind of person, that's a bad thing to be. So there's a lot of conditioning that we have to peel away to get to the real Seijo. But when we go to Mushin, we're starting that process. And it doesn't happen overnight. You know, in Zen we talk a lot about Dai Kensho. Dai Kensho, great awakening. And, you know, if you read Zen literature, there's lots of stories about Zen monks and nuns who have had great awakening experiences very suddenly and dramatically. So there's a story about a Zen monk who had been practicing for 20 years. And he went to his teacher and he said, you know, I've been practicing Zen for 20 years and I have never had a breakthrough. And, you know, I read all these books about breakthroughs and I never have one. So he said, I'm leaving the monastery, I'm going to live a simple life. So he found a little hut in the mountains and he was living a simple life. And one day he was still doing his meditation, and one day he got up and he was raking, and he was raking some gravel, and a particularly large piece of gravel flew up under his rake, and as it flew across the yard and hit a stalk of bamboo, and when it made a little pop, we're told that he had his Dai Kensho. And, you know, there are many stories like this, you know, of people having like these dramatic breakthroughs in Zen. But, you know, actually those are sort of, those are real, those do happen. But, you know, actually those are a little bit like PR too, you know. So you know, really, generally speaking, it's not like that. You know, you're peeling, you're taking down one barrier at a time and you feel a little better. And then you take down another barrier and you feel a little better. And then you take, you know, and so on. So it's really not the case. You know, if you come to a sesshin and you're expecting, you know, to have this amazing breakthrough, you're sobbing and laughing through your tears, and, you know, that could happen. There are cases like that. But it's more typically the case that we're just peeling back the layers of conditioning one layer at a time. You know, there was a very famous Zen teacher who said, everybody wants to talk about the great, you know, Zen masters, but what about the sweating horses? And you know, he's saying, in one way he's saying, everybody wants to talk about Joshu and Linji, but think of the tens of thousands of monks and nuns who have transmitted the Dharma over many generations. We don't know their names, but many of them were deeply awake, and they helped thousands and thousands of people. But the story, the little saying also means, you know, don't worry about the big breakthroughs. Just be a sweating horse, you know, get through this barrier, this obstacle. That's really how it's done. In a way, you know, wanting to have the great Dai Kensho is kind of a cop-out, right? You're asking for the universe to do the work you have to do. Right? So when you do meet people who say, I've been practicing Zen for 15 years and I didn't have Dai Kensho, they're really saying the universe was supposed to deliver this to me. But really, you have to just do the work. And you do, everything's about doing the work. You know, some work makes you feel drained and empty, but some work makes you feel more alive. And this work, I say, makes you free and makes you feel alive in ways that I think nothing else can do. So right now we're sort of on day two of sesshin. This is sort of the sweating horses day, right? You know, your legs hurt, maybe you're tired. We had somebody leave last night who was just, he said, I've only sat, you know, no more than 45 minutes. And in spite of my pitch about beginner's mind, he fled. So I can't really blame him. you know, I hope he'll come back. But, you know, it's not an unusual response to want to run away. This is the hard day, really. But if you hang in there tomorrow, sometime tomorrow, everything is going to change. You know, you're going to be in a very different place sometime tomorrow. You're going to go from the Seijo on the bed to the Seijo who's having a beautiful life because she's free. And the difference is not your circumstances. You know, you'll actually have pain in your legs tomorrow too. The difference is in how you're experiencing the moment. You know, right now we're still sort of experiencing the moment from a self-centered place. But if you do your mushin, if you practice mu, if you practice your koan, tomorrow you're going to leave that place. It's like you step outside of that imaginary person called the I. And as soon as you do, everything comes alive. Everything becomes beautiful. And you become free. Because it's true that Seijo's parents made her prisoner. Seijo's culture made her a prisoner. Seijo's conditioning made her a prisoner. But most of all, what makes us a prisoner is grasping after the self, right? As long as we're thinking from the self-centered standpoint, I, me, you know, we're going to be sick Seijo on the bed. You know, but as soon as we begin to move out of that orbit, and we begin to experience everything from the standpoint of an empty self, everything around us comes to life and we feel connected to the life of everything. So hang in there. Goso said to his monks, Seijo's soul is separated from her being. Which was the real Seijo? Mumon's comment, when you realize what the real is, you will see that we pass from one husk to another, like travelers stopping for a night's lodging. See, that could be about rebirth, right? Like a transmigration from one life to a next. But it's also about identity. You know, we're this, we're that, we're this, we're that, you know. None of those identities is who we really are. But if you do not realize it yet, I earnestly advise you not to rush about wildly. When earth, water, fire, and air suddenly separate, you will be like a crab struggling in boiling water with its 7 or 8 arms and legs. This is a reference to the Buddhism has a kind of apocalypse too. Everything is going to be consumed by a fire, the whole universe. But then everything comes back in the Buddhist view. They're saying at the end of the universe, when everything's consumed by fire, you'll be like a crab struggling with your legs flailing about. But what they're really talking about is living from the self. You know, when you live from the small self, you're always anxious, struggling, fearful, nervous. You know, what's so amazing about Sashin is around day 3 we realize that's not who we really are. So you know, when that happens, don't say I didn't warn you. Mumon's verse. The moon above the clouds is ever the same. Underneath all of these distractions, there's the moon of your true nature, which is shining brightly all the time. Valleys and mountains are separate from each other. All is blessed, all is blessed. Are they one or are they two?